Okay, good evening, everybody. It looks like we're going to go live here. I've enjoyed the little chat there about children. My daughter is 16 years old. I got to spend the weekend with her. My wife and daughter live in a different city for a short time here. And a year ago, she was in a class with an environmental-minded teacher, as they mostly are these days. And the teacher said, take out a piece of paper for a quiz. And then she checked herself and said, no. Just use a half a sheet of paper, because we can save paper by using a half a sheet. So my daughter, this was about a year ago, she was 15. She actually kept out a full page of paper on her desk. And when the teacher came around and noticed, she asked my daughter why she had a full sheet of paper instead of just a half. And my daughter said, paper's cheap. So she's a chip off the old block, and I imagine you all are trying to do the same. So today, let's talk about our topic, which is, I think it might be the highlight of the five lectures. Hopefully the fifth lecture is worth coming back for, but for me, I think this particular project represents, or this particular talk represents, what for me is really the essence of what the Economic Freedom of the World Project was established, so many years ago. The background story on the Economic Freedom Project is that in 1984, a bunch of economists were meeting. It was the Mont-Pelerin Society. And many of you probably know the Mont-Pelerin Society was started by Hayek, and Mises himself was an original founding member, as was Milton Friedman and others. George Stigler was there. And these classical liberal economists and others started this society. Anyway, in 1984, the year 1984, there was a debate about the book 1984. And there was a big debate about whether or not Orwell was right. And some people in the audience, some people at the group thought that Orwell was wrong, because, you know, we didn't have Big Brother in the actual calendar year 1984. It wasn't nearly as bad as Orwell depicted in the book. We didn't have, you know, television screens and such in our rooms and watching us and whatnot. Milton Friedman and Michael Walker, who at that time, Michael was the director of the Fraser Institute, he said, well, maybe that's true politically. Maybe it's true that Orwell's vision of the future had not come to pass politically. We had maintained, at least in the Western countries, we had maintained our freedom of speech, our freedom of assembly, freedom of the press. But Michael Walker suggested that we were losing, in fact, Orwell is right about economic life. Our economic freedoms had been essentially taken away, and that we weren't living in an Orwellian world politically, but we are living in a world, an Orwellian world economically. Anyway, a big debate ensued, and I wasn't there. I was still in high school in 1984. But after this debate was over, Milton and Michael Walker said, you know, what we really need to talk about this question is an index of economic freedom. So the Index of Economic Freedom, in fact, was created, or at least the idea for the index, was because they were interested in the 1980s about the relationship between economic freedom on the one hand and political freedom on the other. And ironically, after we created the Economic Freedom Index, first came out in 1996, the very first thing we all did, we rushed to our computers, we had this new index, and we ran growth regressions. And so, you know, the earlier discussions about economic freedom and growth and such, that was all the kind of the first thing we did. But we forgot that the reason we did the index, or at least the reason that the founding fathers of this index, Milton Friedman and Michael Walker and Walter Block, the reason we wanted to start the index was to investigate empirically the nature of the relationship between economic and political freedom. So, it wasn't until just a few years ago that I decided to take up the question and try to investigate this relationship a little bit more deeply. So with that, we're going to take a look at the topic, which is based on a paper. The paper is recent. It just came out last year in 2010. I think mostly the paper was written in 2009, but it's a relatively fresh paper. And it was published in the Journal of Economic Behavior and Organization. And I believe that you all, again, have a copy of this in your materials that were provided. I should mention my co-author is J.R. Clark, Jeff Clark, who's a professor at University of Tennessee, Chattanooga. And what we want to do is investigate the Hayek-Friedman hypothesis on economic and political freedom. And both Hayek and Friedman, in their own somewhat different ways, made some claims about the relationship between economic freedom and political freedom. And if there's sort of one overarching theme for this entire set of lectures, is that when someone makes an empirical claim, we should investigate that claim empirically. Surely we can investigate any claim with theory, but you know, if someone says A causes B, we have data on A and B, we should check to see whether A in fact at least correlates with B. Because if someone says A causes B, but in the real world A and B aren't related, that is pretty bad evidence for that person's claim. So again, the theme here is at least for me, is to emphasize with you all the power of data, the power of using empiricism, not to prove or disprove our theory, but to bring evidence and to strengthen the theory that we have. So let's talk a little bit about the theory that Milton and Friedrich Hayek had. Starting with Hayek, I should confess that I was a terrible Austrian economist. When I first wrote this paper, I just called it the Friedman hypothesis. And that was because in my mind, and it was partly because I got to know Milton Friedman as part of the early years in this index project. In my mind, I just sort of associated the discussion about economic freedom and political freedom with Milton Friedman from his book, Capitalism and Freedom. So if you, maybe we'll start with Friedman's quote first then, since that was the one I first latched onto. In Capitalism and Freedom, right at the very beginning of the book, indeed on page 9, Friedman makes an empirical claim, and he actually makes the same claim in the video series and eventually the book called Free to Choose a couple decades later. Anyway, he said, historical evidence speaks with a single voice on the relation between political freedom and a free market. I know of no example in time or place of a society that has been marked by a large measure of political freedom and that has not also used something comparable to a free market. So Friedman here is making a claim, empirical. I know of no example in time or place, he says. I know of nowhere, ever, that has been marked with a large amount of political freedom but that has not had something comparable to a free market. And so I had read Capitalism and Freedom, and I again knew Milton in the early years of the foundation of this project, and I said, you know, that's testable. That's a claim. That's, you know, we have data on these things. We should be able to investigate whether or not Milton was onto something here empirically. I wrote up an early version of this paper that we're going to talk about here. And I shopped it, or I sent it around to some friends, including Benjamin Powell. Ben Powell is an Austrian economist. He's a student of Pete Betke at George Mason, and he's a professor at Suffolk University in Boston. And many of you probably know Ben's outstanding work as an Austrian economist. And Ben said, you know, that's a great paper, Bob, but, you know, Hayek said the same thing, 18 years earlier or something. And he says, you know, you really ought to show Hayek some love. And so, and I'm a little bit embarrassed that it had been many years that by this point I had not read The Road to Serfdom in 15 years or so. And I went back and I read The Road to Serfdom, and indeed, of course, I should have known this all along, but indeed, Hayek says essentially the same thing in somewhat different language in The Road to Serfdom. And the best sort of short quote that I've been able to find where Hayek says this is the one you see here at the top. It says, and this is Hayek in The Road to Serfdom, page 77, if capitalism here means here a competitive system based on the free disposal over private property, it is far more important to realize that only within this system is democracy possible. Only within the system of capitalism, if you want to use that word, only within the system of economic freedom is democracy possible. So both Friedman and Hayek are saying in very different ways, they're saying something that I think is very similar. They're both essentially saying here, if you read carefully, now neither of these passages are easy, actually. And, you know, you notice that Milton is using like a double negative here. And it's not exactly easy to see what they're saying in these two passages. In a nutshell, what Friedman and Hayek are saying is that economic freedom is a necessary but not sufficient condition for political freedom. If you look at Hayek, only within the system of capitalism is democracy possible. Friedman is saying, everywhere we have political freedom, we have had something comparable to a free market. So they're both essentially advancing a necessary but not sufficient kind of argument. Economic freedom is necessary for political freedom. We must have some kind of market economy, capitalism, economic freedom, free market, whatever phrase you want to use. We must have some kind of free market if we're going to have democracy or political freedom. They're not saying it's sufficient. They're just saying we must have it if we're going to have political freedom. And Friedman here elaborates a little bit on the next page. He says, you know, the relationship between economic and political freedom is complex and by no means unilateral. That is to say, we're not arguing the reverse. Neither Friedman or Hayek are arguing the reverse. Neither one of them is saying that democracy is necessary or sufficient for economic freedom. Okay? So the claims that Friedman and Hayek are making in these two books are very, very precise and very specific kinds of empirical claims. They're not just saying that economic freedom and political freedom are related to each other. They're not saying that they're correlated. They're saying that economic freedom is necessary for political freedom. Not sufficient, but necessary. And they are not saying the converse. They are clearly not saying that democracy or political freedom is necessary or sufficient, for that matter, for economic freedom. So it's a very unusual claim, and that's why Friedman's, this third quote I put in, is so important. It is a complex relationship, and it isn't unilateral. Okay. So anyway, I set out with the data that we have available to look at these peculiar and precise claims that Friedman and Hayek were making. Now, I think the best way to sort of view this is in a sort of simple 2x2 matrix. Now, we must admit the world is not in a 2x2 matrix. So this is a simplification, but it's a simplification that helps us illustrate what I think Friedman and Hayek were saying. So on the horizontal axis, we have not free economically over here. These are countries that are not economically free, not a market economy, socialist economies. Over on the right side, horizontally, we have, moving from left to right, we have economically free countries. So we have free market capitalism on the right, we have socialism on the left. On the vertical axis, we have political freedom, democracy, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. I'll talk about the distinctions there in a minute, but basically liberal democracy, freedom of speech, freedom of press, and that sort of thing. And then down here we have totalitarian political environments, authoritarian environments where we don't have political freedom at all. And just for the sake of the argument, let's imagine that it's 0-1, not economic free, free. Politically free, not politically free. Let me talk about these quadrants in turn. So up here on the top right quadrant, we have a combination that would be political freedom, democracy, freedom of speech, freedom of press and such, and also economic freedom, market capitalism. And there really are no shortage of examples of countries that are market economies that have some degree of political freedom. The United States is a good example as any. So there's a lot of examples of countries that are relatively economically free and also relatively politically free. Sadly, there's also no shortage of examples in the lower left-hand quadrant, countries that are not economically free and also not politically free. Now, the Soviet Union would be a good example there, and there are no shortage of examples in today's world of this either. Lots of countries that are socialist today or totalitarian, both economically and politically. Now, the bottom right-hand quadrant is the not politically free, economically free quadrant. This is the quadrant that would include, say, Singapore. Singapore, of course, is second on the Economic Freedom of the World Index and not a political democracy, an authoritarian political regime. So we see Singapore here. But this is not, again, this is not a violation of what Hayek and Friedman are saying. Hayek and Friedman were saying that economic freedom is a necessary condition for political freedom, but it's not sufficient. So it's okay to have a Singapore out there, at least as far as Friedman and Hayek's thesis was concerned. The problem for Friedman and Hayek will occur in the upper left-hand quadrant of this 2x2. Countries should not, according to Friedman and Hayek, should not have political freedom. They should not have a lot of political freedom and without having economic freedom. They should not, because economic freedom in the mind of Hayek and Friedman is a necessary precondition, a necessary condition for political freedom. So we should not see anybody in the upper left-hand quadrant. So that this is sort of a good way to say, no problem here, no problem here, no problem here either. The problem is we should not see countries up here in this quadrant, upper left. Okay. So the good news is, again, we have data. Of course, we have data on economic freedom. That's the Economic Freedom of the World Index that we've been talking about the entire course. There is also data on political freedom. There is the best data, that, I mean, the best in the sense that it's the most commonly used, is a data set by the Freedom House Group in New York City. They've been publishing a index of political rights and civil liberties. They've been publishing this index for, well, it first came out in 1972, so you can do the math. So they have a long-running database on political and civil liberties, essentially measuring whether or not countries are using democracy to make collective decisions and whether or not there's a regard for civil liberties. So we have data on both of these dimensions. From our index, we have the economic freedom dimension, and then from the political rights and civil liberties Freedom House index, we have the political freedom index covered. Again, I just remind you, this is what the economic freedom of the world map looks like. Let's move on. No, it's just there. So what I did is I went and I collected the data for the political freedom using Freedom House's data. They have data going back to 1972. The Economic Freedom Index actually goes back to 1970. So I matched up 72's political freedom data with 70's economic freedom data. It's close enough for my purposes, I think. And we have data on the, in five-year intervals. So we have data for 1970, 1975, 1980, 85, 90, 95, 2000, and 2005. And there's approximately, depends on the year, there's approximately, well, there's anywhere between 50 and 100 or so countries, 120 or so countries, really, in each of these years. If you go to 1970, I think we only have about 50-some countries that are represented in the database. By the time you get to 2005, I think we have well over 100. But if you look at all of the combinations where we have data of political freedom and economic freedom for a country, of all from 1970 to 70 to 2005 in five-year intervals, we have 815 country time periods. We have 815 dots. If you want, you could count. There's 815 dots. You can't actually count because they're all merged together. So there's 815 dots here, and each one of these dots represents a particular country at a particular time. So that dot right there, I don't know what it represents, but that might be, Israel in 1980, or it might be, who knows who it is, okay? And so we see different countries all over the place. Now, in terms of the scale here, let me describe the scale. What I did is the Economic Freedom Index, which is on the horizontal axis here, sorry about that. The Economic Freedom Index is on the horizontal axis, and I standardize it. So it's centered on zero. Zero is the average, and it's one unit, one is one standard deviation. So you can see most of the countries are going to fall within plus or minus two standard deviations. Only about, less than 10% will be outside of two standard deviations. Less than that even. So on the Economic Freedom Index, we're centering on zero. That's the average, and one unit represents one standard deviation. In the Political Rights and Civil Liberties Index by Freedom House, I did the same thing. On the vertical scale, the index was centered on it. Zero is the average, and then one unit is one standard deviation. Just a few remarks. The Political Rights and Civil Liberties Index is not very continuous. It goes from zero to seven, and it only in 0.5 increments. So 0.5, 1, 1.5, 2, 2.5, and so on. And so you can see the horizontal bands here are reflecting the fact that the Political Rights and Civil Liberties Index comes in only 0.5 unit increments. Now, then I took that raw data and I standardized it, but we're still seeing these horizontal bands. And that's just the way the data from the Freedom House comes to us. The Economic Freedom Index, on the other hand, is quite continuous. You can see there's looking, horizontally, vertically, there are no bands or anything like that. Okay, so again, I centered both sets of data on zero. So roughly speaking, the Political Rights and Civil Liberties Index was centered on zero. Zero is average. So there's about 50% of the data points, about 400 data points above the horizontal line, and about 400 below the horizontal line. And then likewise for the Economic Freedom Index, looking at the vertical center line, there's about half the data on the left and half the data on the right. They don't exactly have to be 50-50 on each side, but it's approximately that's the way it works. So by construction, I've got 50% on basically left and right and 50% above and below. When I first looked at this, picture, I must say I was a little bit despondent because I said, oh, well, if you look at the previous picture, if you look at the 2x2, I said we shouldn't see anybody in the upper left-hand quadrant. If Friedman and Hayek were correct, there shouldn't be anybody up here in the upper left. And when I first put this table or this graphic together, I see a lot of countries up here in the upper left. But again, remember, by construction, I put half the countries above and half the countries below and half the countries to the left and half to the right. So you're almost guaranteed that you're going to have 25% in each quadrant. That's just sort of the way in which I constructed the array. So I think we need to do a little bit more investigation. For the record, I did run a simple regression. You see this chart is exactly the same as that picture, but in this one I simply ran a regression. And the good news is, if you were just wanting to make the argument that economic liberalism, economic freedom, political or economic capitalism, free markets, if you wanted to make the argument that political or that economic freedom was correlated with democracy or political rights, you can make that argument quite easily. There is an upward sloping statistical relationship. As you get more economic freedom, you get more political freedom. Obviously, there are exceptions here above and below the regression line, but there is a pretty decent relationship between economic freedom and political freedom, and this is something we've remarked upon already. But again, remember Friedman's comment that he was not arguing that economic freedom and political freedom were unilaterally related. So I think a simple regression line, which presumes a unilateral relationship between the two variables, I think that is not the appropriate way to look at the data set. So although I did this regression just to see what it would look like, I do not think this is the appropriate way to consider the data. The appropriate way to consider the data is to sort of look about look at this upper left-hand quadrant and see if there are countries up here in this far upper left-hand quadrant that are potentially violating what Friedman and Hayek were arguing. So, this is the sort of meat of the paper then. Friedman was arguing, and I'm going to use Friedman because his line, I think, was more straightforward in Capitalism and Freedom. Friedman said, it is impossible for countries, and I'll quote, with a large measure of political freedom, end quote. Let's stop there and think about what does it mean to have a large measure of political freedom? You know, I really don't know what it means to have a large measure of political freedom. Just as a guess, I said one standard deviation above average. I just made that up. I said, you know, I don't know what a large measure of political freedom, but if your political freedom index from the Freedom House is one standard deviation above the average, let's go ahead and say that's a large amount. Okay? It's a statistical way to measure largeness, one standard deviation. It's not a very defensible thing because there's no magic line, you know, here, but just as a starting point, I said, let's define a large measure of political freedom to mean one standard deviation above average. And then Friedman went on to say, he said it was impossible for countries to have a large measure of political freedom without, quote, something comparable to a free market. I don't exactly know what it means to be comparable to a free market, again, but just as a guess, I said, well, comparable sounds weaker than large measure, so comparable to a free market, let's suppose that that's, I don't know, one half of a standard deviation above average. So you would not be comparable to a free market if you were less than a half a standard deviation above average. So I looked at that. So I define a large measure of political freedom to be one standard deviation above average and a large measure of and a something comparable to a free market to be above, half a standard deviation above average, and to not have something comparable to a free market to be less than one half a standard deviation above average. Whew. So, let's take a look at the data. Remember, there are 815 pieces of data that we have. We have 815 cases, 850 country time periods. Of the 815 data points that we have, there were 248 cases, 248 instances where a country at some time period in the data set had a political freedom rating more than a standard deviation above average. So there were 248 cases that we found in time in different countries where we had a large measure of political freedom, again, defining large measure of political freedom to be one standard deviation above average. Over here, we have to consider what does it mean to be not comparable to a free market? Well, we're going to define, for the sake of this initial argument, not comparable to a free market to be less than 0.5 above average. And it turns out that in the 815 data sets there, 815 points, there were 550 cases, 550 points in time where a country or a different country was not comparable to a free market. Now, if Friedman was literally correct, again, with the assumption that I've defined large measure of political freedom correctly and the assumption that I've defined something comparable to a free market correctly, if Friedman was literally correct, then there should be no intersection. There should be nothing in the, no overlap. The countries with large amounts of political freedom should not overlap with countries that don't have a large amount, or not something comparable to a free market. In fact, we have 248 over here in this circle, we have 550 in this circle, and there are 76 countries, now that's not 76 countries, there are 76 instances, 76 times where a country, various countries, were in fact, had one standard deviation above average political freedom and were not fairly high on the economic freedom index. So using my first guess as to what Friedman meant by large measure of political freedom and what Hayek meant, or what he meant by something comparable to a free market, my first best guess, in fact, found 76 cases, 76 instances over time in which there were countries that had large amounts of political freedom and not something comparable to a free market, again, using those definitions. So my first approximation of the Hayek-Friedman hypothesis is that Hayek and Friedman were not correct. Now, I should mention that if you look at the data set by year over time, and starting in 1980s, in 1980, that was the high point. In 1980, in terms of violations, there were a lot of violations. About 12% of the countries, I think it was 13 out of 104 or something like that, about 12% of the countries had a large amount of political freedom but did not have something comparable to a free market. So 1980 was the worst time period as far as this thesis was concerned. But since 1980, the number of countries in this red zone here, this violation zone, has fallen. And in by the year 2005, only three countries, it was 2.4% of the data set, only three countries, in fact, I think it was three, were in this red zone. So I think that one of the things we can argue is that maybe Milton Friedman, and if you want to invoke Hayek here, maybe they were exaggerating, and maybe Friedman especially was exaggerating when he said, I know of no country in time or place. Maybe he was exaggerating. Maybe what he meant to say, and this is, we can't ask him now, but maybe what they meant to say was, well, you really do need to have a lot of economic freedom if you want to have a lot of political freedom. And you may not have it all, you may have this combination here sometimes, but it's not going to be sustainable. That is, there will be time periods where a country has a lot of political freedom, but not something comparable to a free market, but that won't last. And indeed, the number of cases that have violated the Hayek and Friedman hypothesis have not lasted. And there's only today just a small handful, only about two or three cases, that are approximating this situation. So if you want to rehabilitate the Hayek-Friedman hypothesis, what I think that you could do is say, well, they didn't really mean it at any point in time, but over time, it maybe it's impossible. I did go ahead and investigate, just for the sake of the argument, what would happen if you changed those thresholds. Remember, I used, for political freedom, for a large measure of political freedom, I used one standard deviation above average. And for economic freedom, I said if you didn't have enough economic freedom, I used 0.5. So the 1 and the 0.5 got me the 76 violations here. But I went ahead because, you know, it's not like, you know, what it's not like large measure of political freedom or something comparable to a free market. It's not like these terms are exactly precise terms. I went ahead and played around a little bit and investigated what would happen if I used different thresholds, political freedom, and different thresholds for the economic freedom. And if I wanted to get zero, if I wanted to make Friedman and Hayek absolutely 100% correct, I would have to, I could keep the political freedom threshold at 1, the way it always was a minute ago, but I'd have to lower the economic freedom to minus 1. That would get me no countries in that sort of red overlap zone. Now, again, Friedman said comparable to a free market. Again, I don't know what comparable to a free market means. To me, comparable to a free market at least means above average. If I used above average, 0, I would still have 32 violations. If I use less than average, maybe a little bit less than average, I would have still some violations. If I use minus 1, that's one standard deviation below average. To me, that's not comparable to a free market. I can get 0. Now, so that would be the best I could do if I wanted to play around with these definitions and I wanted to make Friedman right. But in my mind, that's too generous a reading of what Friedman said. Now, I might add that there was disagreement about this issue. Brian Kaplan, who's a pretty well-known libertarian economist at George Mason University. He's not really an Austrian. At least he claims to not be an Austrian. Brian read this paper, and he said he thought minus 1 was exactly the right threshold to use, and that one, and he didn't know the results. He said, I would pick minus one, and I would pick one, and it turns out that would get you zero violations. So Brian is willing to argue, I guess, that Hayek and Friedman were absolutely 100% correct. His view is that minus one, one standard deviation below average was comparable to a free market. I actually don't think that's that's not fair myself. But so there is argument about what threshold you use. If you use a higher threshold for economic freedom, you are more likely to find violations of the hypothesis. The lower that threshold is, the more friendly you'll be to Friedman and Hayek. On the political freedom index, the same thing. The higher the political freedom index, the more friendly you're going to be to Friedman and Hayek. But we did play around. I think that was the one I chose before I started the project. I decided that 1 and 0.5 were my thresholds. So I stopped there. To me, that's what made sense based on my subjective reading of Hayek, or really my subjective reading of Friedman. So let me pause there and then sort of recap what I think we now know. If you look at the data set, if you look at the data here, let me go back to this chart. If you look at the data, what we see is that there are, in fact, a number of countries. Again, depending on how you define large measure of political freedom and how you define not comparable to a free market, you're going to find countries up here in this upper left-hand quadrant. And you're going to see them, and they're going to be there. Depending on the definition you use, if you use mine, you find 76 examples. I think it's about 30 countries in different time periods. You do see the countries that are in this area don't seem to last. Remember, there was something like a dozen or more in 1980, and today just two or three. So the number has diminished over time. All right. So that's what I think we know, just a scan of the data. Since I had this data set put together, the way I put it together, I thought it might be interesting to look at some individual countries. You know, this 2x2 matrix thing where you have economic freedom on the horizontal axis and political freedom on the vertical axis, this is kind of a really cool way to look at countries. And we have, you know, there's all kinds of, I could do this for all of them. I only did this for about five or six countries in the paper. But it to me was kind of a fascinating example of how we can use these data sets on economic freedom and political freedom to sort of look at what's going on with countries. And so I thought we in the paper we included several examples, several case studies of countries. And the first one's Chile. Now, of course, Chile was the topic, at least part of the topic, in the last conversation, in the last talk. So here you see Chile. Now, in 1970, remember, 1970 is Allende. Allende's Chile had an economic freedom rating that, if you look at the scale, this, remember, vertically, that's average. That's an average economic freedom rating right there, zero. You can see how far to the left Chile is. Very, very far to the left. Well less than one standard deviation below average. If you look at, that's Allende's Chile. If you look at Pinochet's Chile in 1975, so in between 1970 and 1975, Allende was in office in 70, Pinochet was in office in 1975, you see almost no change. And that's, in fact, I think, right. In 1970, we had a socialist running the country. We had very little economic freedom, and we also had very little political freedom. You see, the political freedom index is very low. So despite the fact that Allende won election and something of a fair election, he was not a political liberal, and the Freedom House score for Chile was in 1972 was very, very low. It says 70 here. Remember, the Freedom House index started in 72, but that was Allende's Chile. By 1975, we still have almost the same rating. We have basically political repression. We're down here. We're on the bottom on the vertical scale. We have political repression. less than one standard deviation below average, and economic repression. This is totalitarian statism, socialism, fascism, whatever you want to call it. And then, of course, after a year or so, Pinochet turned the economy over to the Chicago Boys, the so-called Chicago Boys. And that's when the economy began to liberalize. And you can see the stark movement from 1975 to 1980. And in 1975, by 1980, we're way up here. Now, you notice there was very little northerly drift. That's because Pinochet is still in power. Pinochet is still in power in 1980, and he was running his authoritarian political regime. A little bit of upward drift, but essentially Pinochet was running the country in an authoritarian fashion, and there was no real improvement there. But there was a really huge improvement in economic liberalization. This was the era in which the Chicago Boys were liberalizing the economy. You could see that liberalization continue in 1980 to 1985. But again, from 1980 to 1985, no political liberalization. We're not going north at all. We're moving east towards economic liberalization, but not towards political liberalization. And then, of course, between 1985 and 1990, we see the sharp, this is the move to democracy in Chile, the very discreet movement in 87 or so, where Pinochet gives up power, and we go from very low political freedom to reasonably high economic political freedom. But the liberalization, economic liberalization, is continuing. We're still moving to the right. As we continue to 1990 to 2000, we're seeing a continuing liberalization of the economy, continuing liberalization of the economy. And by the time we get to the more recent period, we see that Chile has really made a remarkable journey from totalitarian socialism to totalitarian state fascism almost. Then we went to authoritarian market economy. Then we went to a democracy with a market economy. So Chile has really experienced almost all of the possible combinations you can experience, except for one. You'll notice that Chile never had this experience up here. They never tried to combine political freedom without economic freedom. They were never at any point in time, despite this incredible journey from down here to up here, they were never in violation of the Hayek and Friedman hypothesis. So really, this is a beautiful story. I think if you want to learn about Chile's history, this is really a great starting point. You can really see how Chile has evolved. Okay, so let's take a look at a country that did try to violate, at least to a certain degree, try to violate the Hayek and Friedman hypothesis. I chose Israel. Now, Israel actually isn't a very bad violation. If you look at their political rights index, they were never really above one until recently. But nevertheless, you can see Israel is way over here on the far upper left. In 1970, 1975, 1980 was sort of the worst case. Their economic freedom ratings are just terrible. I mean, in the 1970s and 80s, the Israeli economy, under the sort of ideological influence of socialist Zionism and, you know, the kibbutz and so forth, attempted to run a borderline Soviet-style centrally planned economy. And in this entire period, they had relatively high political freedom ratings. You can see they were well above average. You know, they had the issues with the Palestinians, of course, but for the most part, at least for Israeli citizens, there was free speech, freedom of press, free and fair parliamentary elections, all the things you think of about democracy. But they had terrible economic liberties. Now, of course, in the 70s and in the 80s, the Israeli economy was really a disaster. Hyperinflation, very low productivity, very low growth. People were migrating from Israel to the United States and Europe in great numbers. And in 1980, they began a period of liberalization. So you can see the liberalization, 80 to 85, moving to the east again, moving from less economic freedom to more, 90, 95, a big jump, 2000 and 2005. So today, when you think of Israel, I hope you think about a country that is both pretty high on the economic freedom scale. They're well above one standard deviation above average. And they're politically free as well. So Israel is a country that tried, to a certain extent, tried to be a violator of that Hayek and Friedman hypothesis. They dallied, if you will, with low economic freedom and high political freedom, but it didn't work. And the reason it didn't work, of course, is because the economy was a shambles. And when the economy is a shambles, people demand change. In Israel's case, the change that they got was economic liberalization. Right? They privatized the industries. They reined in the rampant money creation that created the hyperinflation of the 70s and 80s in Israel. And slowly but surely, Israel's economic liberalization took hold. And today, Israel, I think it's fair to say, Israel today is a market economy. It's not a free market economy, but it's a market-oriented economy and also a liberal democracy. It's up here with a lot of other countries. So I think this is really exemplifying that sort of long-run vision of Friedman's hypothesis that Friedman literally said he knows of no example in time or place, but what I think he meant to say, if I could put words in his mouth, was that it's not sustainable. Being over here in this upper left-hand quadrant is not sustainable. And the reason it's not sustainable is because if you're in the upper left-hand quadrant, you have a democracy, but you have a bad economy. And bad economies, in democracies anyway, the democracies demand change. Israel moved towards liberalization, and today the growth rates in Israel and the productivity in Israel is quite high. So that's a good story. This is a story about how the Hayek-Friedman violation, it's a good ending. The good ending is we went to the upper right-hand quadrant where we have economic liberalization and political liberalism. I must say that it doesn't always work out so well. Here we see Venezuela. Venezuela has also had a crazy journey. And as you can see, in 1970, Venezuela had a pretty high economic freedom rate. It wasn't above 1, but it was well above 0.5. It was, I guess you'd say, it was comparable to a free market, and well above average anyway. And what Venezuela did in the 70s and the 80s is what a lot of Latin American countries did. Under the influence of the ideology, progressive ideology, liberation theology and such, they began to institute a variety of progressive reforms that weakened economic liberalization. We nationalized industries, we regulated import substitution, money creation in order to alleviate debtors, and so the economic freedom index began to move from right to the left. We moved west. We moved from more economic from the left. Zigzagged a little bit, but you can see the general trend from 1970 to 1990 was clearly moving to the left. And by the time you get into the 1990s, what do we have now? We have a Venezuela that's over here. They still have political freedom. In 1970s, 80s, and into the beginning of the 1990s, Venezuela was still a reasonably high-functioning liberal democracy in the sense that they had numerous newspapers operating and television stations and journalists and freedom of press and speech. You had competitive parties vying for elections and such. So we still had political freedom into the late 80s and early 1990s. The problem was by this time, we had moved away from economic freedom. We moved to the left economically. And the economy was beginning to suffer dramatically. This is the era in which we began to nationalize the oil industry. And the economy begins to suffer dramatically. Growth rates fall. They turn negative, in fact. And people begin to become poorer, not richer. And at this point, it's where the Venezuelan democracy looks for a solution. What happens in a democracy when the economy is doing poorly? Democracy looks for a fix. In Israel's case, the fix for the bad economy was economic liberalization. In Venezuela's case, the fix for the economic problems was Hugo Chavez. Hugo Chavez became in power, and as soon as Hugo Chavez became in power, what happens? Boom, we start going this way. We start going from political freedom to less political freedom. In fact, if you go, this is 2005, if you go down to 2010, today's period, you see that Hugo Chavez has the country. Well, actually, it's somewhere right about where that arrow is right there. It's far to the bottom left-hand quadrant. So this is sort of the not happy ending to the Hayek-Friedman hypothesis. Here we had a country, Venezuela, that attempted to, for a brief period, to combine political liberalism without economic liberalism. Well, when you don't have economic liberalism, your economy functions poorly. And then you look for a solution. And Chavez was the solution. And voila, we go down here. And now Venezuela is in the bottom left-hand quadrant, combining low political freedom and low economic freedom. So it's sort of not happy ending. It's the opposite of the Israeli case. Okay. If you look around the world at the countries that were up here in the upper left-hand quadrant, however, more of them look like Israel. Most of them that were up here moved to the right economically and maintained their political liberalism. It's only a few, like Venezuela, that have done this sort of tailspin to the south. All right, one last chart, and then we'll have some time for discussion. This is sort of off the topic in a way, but I thought I would look, actually it's two last charts, I thought we would look at some of the countries that were in the bottom right-hand quadrant. Remember, Hayek and Friedman were essentially silent about countries down here. Again, Hayek and Friedman said that economic freedom was a necessary but not sufficient condition for political freedom. So here we have Taiwan. Taiwan in the 1970s, by the time you get to the 1980s at least, Taiwan is something comparable to a free market. It's certainly a market economy by the 1980s. But it was also, in the 1980s, being run by a military government without a lot of an authoritarian military government. So during this period, Taiwan is trying to have these sort of other oddball combination, this combination of high economic liberalism but not high political liberalism. And again, Friedman and Hayek really had nothing to say about it. But just out of curiosity, I thought I'd pull up Taiwan. And what we see Taiwan did, of course, is in the late 80s and early 90s, they shot up here. This was the period in the late 80s and early 90s where the student protests in Taipei and such, and the generals were overthrown. And today, you know, if you look at Taiwan's ratings today, they're still about as economically free as they were in the 80s. But they're now but they're vastly more politically free, and so Taiwan is a country that moved out of this lower right hand quadrant into the upper left hand quadrant. Now again, Friedman and Hayek had very little to say about that, and indeed the next country sort of illustrates another possible situation. And this is Singapore. Singapore, in fact, has just sort of been spinning around in circles here in this bottom left hand. Quadrant. 70, 75, 80, 85, they're just basically spinning around. Obviously, they're very, very high on the economic freedom scale. They're more than two standard deviations above average. I mean, they're number two in the entire world. So Singapore's economic freedom rating is extraordinarily high. But as you can see, their political freedom rating is pretty low. It's not that low. I might mention it's not below one standard deviation, but it's below average. And it's an authoritarian regime. And so if you look at Singapore here, you see this sort of spinning around. And I'm not sure if what Taiwan did there is ever going to happen in Singapore. Okay? I just don't know. And a lot of people ask me questions about the Singapores of the world, about whether or not Singapore is going to match is ever going to move up to the upper right. And honestly, I do not know. I know that Friedman and Hayek were ambivalent about that as well. They really had ambivalence about this sort of area down here. They were quite clear that they didn't think you could be up here, but they were ambivalent about down here. And we see a lot of countries down here. We see Taiwan in the 1980s. We see Singapore today. We see China trying essentially to move in that direction, although they're still not that high in economic freedom, but they're trying to move in that direction. You see the oil-rich countries like Oman, United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait, which score pretty high on the Economic Freedom Index, but pretty low on the political freedom scale. So we see a lot of countries out here in this bottom right-hand quadrant, but we really don't have a firm theory, at least I don't have a firm theory, as to what to expect. We've seen some countries get out of that box like Taiwan. I could also assume South Korea. The picture would look very similar to Taiwan's. But we see other countries that seem to be pretty content in this period of time in this lower right. So I'm pretty confident in saying that countries that are in the upper left-hand quadrant are not going to stay there long. The countries that have been up here have moved either to the upper right or in some cases to the lower left, like Venezuela. But down here in the lower right, I'm a little bit ambivalent. I'm not sure. Hayek and Friedman had nothing to say about it. So, the data are still, we'll have to wait and see. Okay. So that's the paper. And let me just conclude. I think the Hayek and Friedman hypothesis holds up fairly well to empirical scrutiny. Although there are examples of violations, those examples tend to be diminishing through time. And I also think that this particular way of arraying the data, of organizing the data, is a pretty cool way of looking at individual countries. So that's the conclusion for the main presentation. And we've got some time for questions and answers. I'm going to close my video so I can open up the Q&A box. And I've also seen some chats here. Again, I try to avoid looking at the chats during the talk, but let me try to pick out a few things and I'll remark. And then if there are new questions that I provoke or if there's questions you're waiting to have, please send them on to the Q&A box or to the chat box. Doesn't really matter to me. Daniel, you ask about Scandinavia being in the top left quadrant. Actually, let me try to get back here. There we go. Actually, no. Remember, most of Scandinavia is in the upper right-hand quadrant. And of course, they're pretty high in they're extremely high in the political and civil liberties index. They're in the upper quadrant, And as far as being in the right, they're in the right mostly. Again, the lowest rated Scandinavian country is Sweden, and they're like even today they're 75th percentile. So, they're not that bad. They're not out here with Hong Kong with the United States, but they're in this area here. So Scandinavia is not in the top left. They're not even close to in my mind, they're not even close to a violation of the Hayek and Friedman hypothesis. The bottom line is they're not that socialist. They have high taxes, but otherwise they're not that socialist. So, all right. Yeah, let me talk about some of the definitions here. Is economic freedom and political decentralization synonymous? Well, Mark, no. Clearly the answer to that is no. I mean, I don't think you can make that case at all. I wanted to mention that Hayek and Friedman themselves, again, they were talking about a generation apart. Hayek was writing right after World War II, of course, for the Road to Serfdom, essentially during World War II, but right after. And Friedman was writing in the early 1960s. And when in Hayek's mind, when he was writing The Road to Serfdom, he was really more interested in what I would call, or what you might call, the formal trappings of democracy, freedom of voting, free fair elections, political parties, things of that sort. Friedman, I think, had a much more all-encompassing view. When Friedman was talking about political freedom, in fact, he didn't use the word democracy much. He used the word political freedom, because I think Friedman's discussion of political freedom was more broad than just, free and fair elections with competitive political parties and free speech. Friedman included civil liberties, freedom of the press, and such that were broader. So I think the two writers did have a somewhat different view of what political freedom and democracy really meant. I think Friedman was much more of a civil libertarian than Hayek in this regard. Hayek was really writing about democracy in the somewhat narrow sense of that term. But I don't think there's any question that political decentralization is different. There is some work on this. By the way, My dissertation was partly on political decentralization, but I think the evidence there is also quite quite mixed. Yeah, okay, let's see. Alicia, you're asking a question. I'll be an exchange student from Mexico to Singapore next semester. Well, you know what, I'd be very interested to see what your reaction is. You know, Mexico is really in the middle of the pack economic freedom wise. They're far from the worst example of socialism on the planet, but they're clearly not a market economy either. And likewise, Mexico is not the most authoritarian place on earth, but it's really not the most liberal democracy in the world either. So you're going to go from Mexico, which is decidedly sort of in the middle of the pack in both dimensions, to Singapore, which is pretty high on the economic freedom dimension, but pretty low on the political freedom dimension. And it's pretty hard when if you're visiting to tell the difference. So you're going to see Singapore is very rich, much richer than Mexico, but you're probably going to find you probably won't notice the political freedom much. I mean, you see wealth all around you. You see the income all around you, but political freedom is something you probably is not as tangible. So you probably will look at Singapore and say, wow, it's great here. It's wonderful here. Look how rich they are. And you won't notice the political authoritarianism as much. At least that's not as surface. It's not as available on the surface. Brian Kaplan also, and twice I've mentioned Brian. Brian Kaplan has argued that Singapore is not nearly as authoritarian as their reputation. At least for most people. Steve, you know it's illegal to eat food on the DC subways too, so it goes around. Let me try to pick out another question here. Oh, you're actually from the East studying now. Okay, gotcha. Wow, Danny, where? I guess, dude, that's a wonderful quote from Mises, and I'm embarrassed that I'm at teaching for the Mises Institute here, and I didn't know that quote. I did look for a good Mises quote, and I didn't find one. It's pretty hard to search through human action. At least I find it hard. I guess I could have written another paper called the Hayek-Friedman-Mises Hypothesis. That's a beautiful quote. I'm gonna put that on Facebook tomorrow. Sorry, I missed it. All right. Okay. All right. So, yeah, you know, there's some discussion of India above, and I just want to mention, you know, one of the funny things I thought about during this project was, you know, Friedman was writing in 1962, and Friedman knew about India. India, he visited India. I mean, he was, you know, it's not like he didn't know about it. India in the 1960s was trying to be a Soviet Union with a democracy. So at the very time Friedman wrote those words in Capitalism and Freedom, he says, I know of no example in time or place of a country that has had a large measure of political freedom without something comparable to a free market. When he wrote that phrase, that sentence, he knew darn well that India existed. And India is a great example of a country that had a pretty large measure of political freedom and certainly nothing comparable to a free market. So at the very time Friedman wrote those words, he should have known that he was exaggerating his case. And that's exactly what we find in this paper, that there's some exaggeration in Friedman's case. Just want to say someone said something nice to me, and I want to acknowledge that because that was cool. J. Cheryl, you say this is great. Thank you. That's the nicest comment I've ever heard, that I'm unbiased. There you go. Mark, doesn't Brian argue that democracy is economically efficient in the myth of the rational voter? Well, arguing that democracy is economically inefficient is certainly nothing new. And I'm a public choice scholar myself. And Brian brings a somewhat different argument to the table than some of the standard public choice arguments. But there's a number of arguments. There's no shortage of arguments about why democracy is inefficient on many, many margins. The short-sightedness effect, the rational ignorance problem, special interest problems. Brian added into it a sort of new dimension, what I think you could call rational irrationality, the idea that voters are irrational. All of these things exist in democracies. And I think it's okay to say democracies are economically inefficient. However, the old stupid saying about how, you know, democracy is the worst form of government except for all the rest, I think still holds. I mean, there's an ample amount of evidence. There's just loads and loads of evidence that democracies, despite their various inefficiencies, which we can enumerate until we're blue in the face, in fact do perform better than authoritarian regimes in general. I mean, I think there is inefficiency in every economic and every political system, and we can identify those inefficiencies in democracies quite readily. But you know, authoritarian regimes don't have a very good record either in terms of the efficiency. So. I think Brian was correct, and I'm a big fan of Brian Kaplan's work. And if you haven't read The Myth of Rational Voter, I think it's going to go down as being one of the most important books in public choice ever written. Mark. You asked me if I would disagree with Hoppe. I'm not exactly sure what you mean by that, so you might have to elaborate. The short answer is almost certainly yes. I confess I have not read a lot of Hans Hoppe's work. Again, I'm only at best a fellow traveler with the Austrians, I suppose. But where I have looked at his work, we definitely tend to disagree. The democracy is a god that fails. No, I think democracy is a god that fails. I absolutely do agree with that. I think democracy is terrible. I think it's a disaster. I think, having said that, I think authoritarian political environments are probably worse in almost every case. If you line up every democracy on Earth and compare it to the authoritarian regimes that exist on Earth, it's not a very difficult case to make, I think. The democracies are better. And that's not to say that they're gods, that they're perfect. And I think that one of the things that public choice scholars have done is they have, in fact, demystified democracy. It is not a god. It is not a perfect way to organize societies. I think the perfect way to organize society is not having either democracy or I'm an anarcho-capitalist at heart. But given the world we live in, I think it is completely irrational to argue in favor of authoritarian regimes over democracies. The evidence is simply just not even close. It's overwhelming that democracies outperform authoritarian regimes, and I think for some fundamental reasons. That doesn't mean they work anywhere near as perfectly as they do. I think he was wrong with monarchies too. I really do. And again, bear in mind my major beef here is you can certainly find examples of authoritarian regimes that outperform democracies. You can find Singapore. Singapore is an authoritarian regime that outperforms most democracies. Those examples exist, but they're the exception, not the rule. Okay, I think I don't know if I missed the question. I apologize. It's hard to actually for me to scroll through the chats. If I scroll up through the chats and then someone adds one, it bounces me down. But I think I've addressed most of the questions that I see or issues I've seen. If there are new ones, I'll be happy to address those. Authoritarian governments have a higher variance outcome than democracies. Does that mean democracies are better? I don't think there's any question. On democracies are better on average and have a lower variance. I think that's the evidence. I think that's, and I don't even think it's a close call. If you were randomly landing yourself on planet Earth and you had a straight up choice between authoritarian government on the one hand and democracy on the other, and you knew nothing else, I would choose to land in a democracy. Now, having said that, if I could land in an authoritarian free market, I'd probably do that as well. I mean, that's not a problem. But the reality is most market-oriented economies are liberal democracies, and very, very few authoritarian governments are liberal or economically free. And, you know, so that's the bottom line. My definition of democracy. You know, I don't think of in 0-1s. So I don't think of 0-1 democracy. I see a scale. To me, it's a scale. You have more democratic and less democratic. And I'm sort of open-ended about it. I think in terms of Friedman more than I do Hayek here. I'm thinking of freedom of speech, the extent to which you have freedom of speech, the extent to which you have freedom of press, the extent to which elections are free and fair, the extent to which political parties are open and so forth. I mean, there's a lot of dimensions to the term democracy. It's not 0-1, and that's why I think you have to use, just like with economic freedom, it's not 0-1. You're not free market or socialist. There are shades of gray in between. I think it's the case with political rights or civil liberties or democracy. But I do have a somewhat more open definition of democracy. I think that a country that has free and fair elections, but that stones shoplifters to death is not a democracy. It's certainly not a very good one. So Singapore has democracy in the narrowest sense of that term. Singapore has elections. And those elections are free and fair in the sense that people go to the booths, that the votes are counted fairly, there's no fraud and such. But it's an authoritarian regime. Freedom of speech is not well protected. Freedom of the press is not well protected. So when I think of democracy, I think about more than just the formal trappings of democracy. I think of the broader civil liberties that go along with that. Mark, I do not vote. I'm a proud non-voter. I respect people who vote, I have voted in my life, but some years ago I decided to become a non-voter. At some point in life, when you realize the choice is between the lesser of two evils, my attitude is to choose neither. So. They're going to violate my rights, but they can violate my rights without my permission. So that's my own view. I respect people who vote. I mean, everybody comes to it from different perspectives on that. But I don't vote. And no, I don't participate in politics either. Not much at all. How about one more question? I'd almost rather stay here and talk to you all night. I've got a stack of about eight inches, a stack of papers to grade in the next day. So the more I talk to you, the longer I can delay grading those horrible papers. All right, yeah, so we're going to go ahead and conclude. A lot of questions all of a sudden, okay. I'll take the last two here real quickly, and then we'll conclude. Then you're asking, is the quality of economics students gone up or down? It's really hard for me to answer that. I've changed jobs from different schools, and as you go from school to school, the quality of students always change, and it's hard to tell. But you know, there is no, I don't know of a single professor in any discipline, economics or not, that thinks the quality of students has gone up in their career. And it's possibly because everybody gets old and curmudgeonly as they get old and grumpy. But no, I think that the reality is the quality of students has gone down. And I think that's the case in my own experience, although I've gone from less good schools to more prestigious schools over my career. So actually, the current crop of students I have at SMU is outstandingly good, is outstanding. I mean, the SMU is I'm teaching MBA in the MBA program. Our MBA program is ranked like 15th in the country. So the quality of our students is exceptionally high. So over the course of my career, I've gone from teaching worse students to better students, but it's not because the students are getting better, it's because I've gone from worse to better schools. And then Mark, this will be the last one we'll take, I think. Excellent question. How important is TiVo competition in ensuring economic freedom? I think TiVo competition is extremely important. Again, that was my dissertation topic 20 years ago. I still think it's important. TiVo competition reflects what people voting with their feet, or capital voting with their feet. I think that we should think about it as both people and capital voting with their feet, so that when a political jurisdiction is hostile to people in their economic lives, that they move. And movement within a country and movement from country to country, I think, is an extraordinarily powerful force in assuring economic freedom. And that's one of the reasons why I'm in favor of human migration, which we'll talk about in the next lecture, actually. And I think it's really, really quite important. I think it's important in the United States. I think one of the reasons why the United States is still as economically free as it is because we have the competition between the 50 states. I think that Switzerland and Canada are also the three most decentralized countries in the world are the United States, Canada, and Switzerland. And all three of those countries are in the top 10 of the Economic Freedom Index. I don't think that's a complete coincidence. This particular paper, Mark, should be one of the papers I provided to Danny Sanchez and the Mises Institute. And I think it's on your list. And if it's not, email me and I'll be happy to provide it. Okay. All right. Any other questions? All right, guys. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. And we have one more to go. And this last one, if you're a fan of Hoppe, might really make you mad. I don't know. The last topic will be about freedom of mobility. And we're going to present an index of ease of travel index. It's going to be a preliminary paper, but it's something that's new that I'm working on that hopefully you'll enjoy. Thank you all very much.